This is Queen Elizabeth, speaking to you from the 16th century. Nothing displeases me more than history myths. And you know what I do when I get displeased? Get an axe and chop off some heads? No! I summon Professor Buzzkill, who explains everything, and I'm totally stoked that he's here again. Join me in listening to a new episode.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's your favorite professor here, and once again, I say this every time, but it's absolutely true. I'm here with your favorite professor, and that's Professor Philip Nash from Penn State, who's with me today to discuss the Pentagon Papers. How are you, Professor?
Doing great, thanks.
I hope you've brought briefcases full of documents smuggled in to talk about not only what happened, but of course, the now famous movie that's come out recently with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep in the starring roles about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, and it was hell copying these because I've got this massive Xerox copier. It takes forever. It takes up half my office. It's a real drag.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are buzzkillers out there who have seen the movie wondering, why didn't they just scan them? And it's one of the big scenes in the movie is watching the old Xeroxes work. Throughout this episode, we'll probably critique the movie, talk about the movie a little bit, but there's so much more depth in what was going on, so much more detail, and of course, a lot of myths and misunderstandings about what the Pentagon Papers were and what they symbolized and what they, in effect, did. So let's start there, Professor. What were the Pentagon Papers?
Exactly. What are these Pentagon Papers everyone talks
presumably
about?
Presumably there are a lot of papers in the Pentagon, but what are these ones?
Right. Well, that's important, too, because the movie's about, it's called The Post. It's about the newspapers and the Pentagon Papers. It really doesn't talk about the papers themselves very much. Mm-hmm. Pentagon Papers were a top secret study commissioned in, I believe, 1967 by the then Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, who does show up in the movie and doesn't come out looking very good.
Well, he's too young. That guy who plays him is too young. Yeah,
a little bit.
Problem.
Right. And he doesn't come out looking very good, and for some good reasons. It's a top secret report commissioned by McNamara. Its title is United States-Vietnam Relations 1945 to 67.
Oh, 1967. That's an important fact we'll have to get to later on.
Right. So it only goes up, even though it's finished in early 69 when Nixon's coming into office, it stops in the Lyndon B. Johnson administration. McNamara is inspired by a previous report that was conducted for John F. Kennedy on the Skybolt affair, which involved nuclear weapons in the British late 1962.
Oh.
And Richard Neustadt, who was a Harvard academic, was hired to basically go through all the – because it was a big diplomatic disaster, and they wanted to find out what had gone wrong. And so they commissioned someone to write this report, which was very well received inside the government. It was top secret. It wasn't declassified until the 1990s.
The Skybolt report.
Okay. That's right. And so McNamara commissions this study basically – it's partly for future historians, mm-hmm. partly to learn from our mistakes. You know, in some ways, McNamara is not like a lot of other people in the government – even though he is obviously a problematic and complex figure. It was not and was never intended to be truly comprehensive. For example, it heavily relies on Department of Defense, Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Pentagon's own documents, but doesn't, for example, represent a lot of stuff from the National Security Council.
Okay.
Or the White House or the State Department.
So it doesn't even represent the whole military side of things?
Not really. Well, certainly not the whole political side of things.
Okay,
and
it's
partly because the McNamara and his people, they're deliberately keeping people like Secretary of State Dean Rusk, the President Lyndon Johnson, and perhaps most of all Johnson's National Security Advisor, Walt Rostow, keeping them out of the loop. Because they're afraid that if they let these people know that they're doing the study, that the study will be shut down.
Okay.
So
we don't know that there's any Kennedy, LBJ.
No. I don't think there's anything about that. But in other words, especially Walt Rostow, who's after McGeorge Mundy, he's the national security advisor for LBJ and one of the hawkiest of the hawks, and really, really would just sort of blow a gasket if he found out that people were doing this top secret internal study, and so he would have gotten in the way. So it's produced by about 36 people.
Right.
It's about half of them are military officers. At one point, in fact, for most of the project, it's led by Leslie Gelb, who's a pretty famous name. He's a journalist and also a government official, and then later an academic. They end up producing a truly massive report. It's about 7,000 pages all in.
7,000?
7,000 pages, about 3,000 pages of analysis and 4,000 pages of documents.
Okay, because you get the impression, at least from the movie, and I'm going to say that a lot in this episode, Buzzkiller. Sorry about that. But I certainly remember reading about the Pentagon Papers in the 70s. But anyway, you get the impression that it was all done at Rand Corporation. But there are a lot more people involved.
No, in fact, it was not done at the Rand Corporation. Okay. Rand ended up with a copy in its files.
There were at least
a couple of Rand people, including Ellsberg himself at one point, who were detailed to this operation to work on parts of the study. And part of the papers were actually compiled and written by Ellsberg. I think the part on 1961, he did part of that. But, you know, it's such a sprawling, massive project, you know, with anything, you know, no single person is going to produce a report that's 7,000 pages long.
Right.
And it's done by early 1969. That's what, as I think I mentioned, it's ready for the incoming Nixon administration that starts that year. And then it's leaked famously by Daniel Ellsberg, who does show up in the movie a little bit. And partly what I want to do here is tell a little bit about his story, because it's the part you really don't see in the movie. He's kind of a fascinating guy.
I have to say, the fact that he was played by the guy who played the lead in that famous show, The Americans, where the American couple plays the communist spies.
Is a nice little touch.
This guy is a one-trick pony. He can only play spies and underground people.
People engaged in skullduggery. Yeah. Daniel Ellsberg,
I should know his name, but I don't.
Yeah, it's Matthew Riss, I think is his name, or Reese, however you pronounce his name. So Daniel Ellsberg, born in Chicago in 1931, he gets a bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard in 1952, then joins the Marine Corps and becomes, he's commissioned as a junior officer. He's a lieutenant. I think he steps out as a first lieutenant. Don't quote me on this. I remember hearing once that, you know, they have lots of competitions within the military.
Yeah,
he may have been in charge of the top-rated platoon in the entire Marine Corps.
Oh.
I remember hearing that once. So in other words, he was obviously, and he's one of these people who, like, he's almost obsessive. Mm-hmm. In other words, wants to be the very best at everything he does and works super, super hard. He's super disciplined, sort of insane, over-the-top effort. Uh-huh. I think you see that there. So he's in the Marine Corps in the mid-50s. Leaves the Marine Corps, becomes a fellow at Harvard, and then joins the RAND Corporation, which RAND, the letters come from Research and Development. This was a private, nonprofit think tank, in some ways the original think tank.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting on its own.
Satirized in the movie Dr. Strangelove as the Bland Corporation, which I also think is hilarious.
These two movies should be seen one after the other.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so he works at RAND, and he's one of their – they put together an amazing team of brilliant people. And he spends a lot of time in Santa Monica, California, where RAND was and is, studying nuclear war and nuclear strategy and how to avoid nuclear war. That becomes almost an obsession with him.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why his most recent book just came out last year. It's called The Doomsday Machine. It's about partly his own story about studying nuclear war and how to avoid it. He gets his PhD in economics from Harvard in 1962 in decision-making theory, not surprisingly, considering what he's working on. The nuclear war is certainly his focus. So he's basically – he's super brilliant, hard – and he's a cold warrior. He admits it in his memoir. He's on board for basically protecting the United States and keeping the United States strong and secure, relying on nuclear weapons. He believed in our commitment to Vietnam at first.
Uh-huh.
No question about that. So around 1964, he leaves RAND. I think he might have still had status at RAND, but he's sort of detailed to the Pentagon. He works for Robert McNamara's assistant secretary of state, a guy by the name of John McNaughton, who may not be a household name, but he's a pretty important guy. He works for McNaughton. So he's the assistant to the assistant of the secretary of defense, and actually has a lot of access. First of all, he has a super high top secret security clearance. He has a lot of access to top people. He writes memos that are put in front of the president.
Oh, okay.
So
what date is this? So we know
this is 64.
Okay, so this is LBJ.
This is under LBJ. That's right. And we haven't yet Americanized the war in Vietnam, but we have a lot of advisors there.
Right.
And Vietnam is a huge issue. So he works for McNaughton, this assistant secretary of defense, for I think about 2 years, and then he goes to Vietnam in like 65 and 66. He's a civilian, obviously, but he's detailed to our pacification program.
There's a pacification program?
Yeah, the program. In other words, how do we sort of combat the influence of the Viet Cong in the countryside? How do we sort of win? Sometimes it's called hearts and minds. You win the support of the populace. And basically studying that problem. He spends a lot of time with Edward Lansdale.
Yeah, we see that he's in Vietnam in 65, 66, the movie with longer hair than all the other
guys. Right.
But that's not his earlier service.
Correct. Right. Okay. Yeah, that he's just tagging along. In fact, that opening scene is a little misleading because the important thing is not him sort of being caught in an ambush.
Yeah.
The important thing is he spends a lot of time with people like John Paul Vann, who's the subject of this famous book, Bright Shining Lie. By Neil Sheehan.
Yeah.
And he comes to understand the problems we have and how, for example, the regime doesn't have and doesn't deserve any popular support in the rural areas and how...
In Vietnam.
And how the South Vietnamese army is not very effective and how our own military operations are not getting anything done. In other words, on the ground in Vietnam, he discovers what he would say is the truth, which is this is sort of a war we can't win. This is a losing effort. And he does what a lot of American civilians don't do in Vietnam, which is he leaves the base and he goes out into some dangerous areas and finds out what things are really like. And he's very good about this in his memoir because a lot of Americans basically, including people in the press, including touring politicians, they go there, they land at a base, they get briefed in the base by people who have never left the base,
right?
Who don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And so they
might as well be back in the U.S.
Right. And so they get these sort of these very rosy reports about progress. And one of the things the movie does very well is it has this scene where Ellsberg's on a plane with this Defense Secretary McNamara on the way back to the United States.
Yeah.
And McNamara on the plane in private is clearly very dubious about the war. And then he gets off the plane and gives a press conference. Yeah. You remember the scene?
Yeah.
And he says, things are going great. And, you know, Ellsberg overhears that. That's actually how that happened. And that's part of Ellsberg's disillusionment, basically.
Yeah, because it's so brazen.
Right, and he knows that McNamara has a pretty good handle on how poorly things are going, but is unwilling to be square with the public about that.
Yeah,
and that's part of Ellsberg's awakening.
Okay, so this happens again in 65, 66.
That's right. And so he actually contracts hepatitis and is out of action. Ellsberg does and has to go back. He goes back to the United States and works at the Department of Defense in around 1967 and works on the Pentagon Papers.
Mm-hmm.
So you should always keep in mind, and he stresses this in his autobiography, this whole time he's a very, very enthusiastic participant in this growing, what you might call sort of a secrecy bureaucracy. That the Pentagon, the White House, National Security Council, State Department, you've got thousands of people who have top secret security clearances, and they're basically part of this inner circle. Even it's a big circle, but they're part of it.
Yeah, okay.
And being part of it is very seductive.
Right.
It's very intoxicating.
Oh, sure.
You have access.
Other people don't know. Yeah.
You know what other people don't know. You have access to, basically unfettered access to all these documents. You're close to power.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like you have access to people who make decisions, make big decisions that affect people's lives.
And in theory, they're listening to you.
And in theory, they're listening to you, or they might listen to you someday. And that makes you want to be basically a team player. That makes you want keep the secrets, be on board, don't rock the boat, don't ask hard questions of your superiors, do as you're told, because you really don't want to be cut out.
Uh-huh. Right. Sure.
And so that often gets overlooked when you study foreign policy and foreign policy making and defense policy making, that there is the sort of inside outside dynamic.
Yeah.
And you know, later on we'll study some disaster and say, wow, why didn't people raise questions? Well, that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, because they're in the club.
They're in the club, and they don't want to jeopardize that status.
Yeah.
The problem is, someone like Ellsberg comes to realize, well, what's the point of being in the club?
Well, exactly.
if you're going to be part of this disaster.
Yeah.
That knows it's a disaster and continues to prosecute it anyway.
So we've got him up to, he's back at DOD in this club, 67, 68. How do things start to happen? What happens as 68 turns into 69 and on and on?
Right. Well, 69 is the key year in his biography because that's the year he really comes out against the war.
Oh, okay. Is that
privately at first?
Just because of what he's reading and seeing inside, or is he
that's
the protesters?
Part of it, yeah, he's also, before this, he already has his doubts starts to have his doubts about what he's doing. But what pushes him over the edge is his sort of exposure to the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one incident in particular, I think it's Pennsylvania. he goes to an anti-war rally and hears a speech by a draft resister who is headed to jail because he's resisting the draft. Yeah, sure. And that clearly pushes Ellsberg over the edge, and he is essentially has a, I wouldn't call it a nervous breakdown, but he basically goes into this, goes into a bathroom at the event and basically sobs, sits down on the floor and sobs.
Oh, wow.
Because he's just he's overcome by his own guilt, his own just sense that here's someone in front of me who is doing the right thing and I'm doing the wrong thing. And then you have to be willing to risk a lot to do the right thing in this context.
Oh, is he feeling? Does he feel himself a little bit responsible? Oh, absolutely. In a general sense, for these people going to jail.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, and also that he feels like he's in a position to do the right thing, and he has chosen not to, and that clearly has disturbed him very, very deeply. And I should say, if I can just interject here. I was in graduate school in the late 1980s, and he visited a graduate seminar of ours.
Right.
And at one point during, I remember this very clearly. One point during the seminar, he became very emotional and started crying.
Wow.
Which, and in retrospect, and I remember the time was very uncomfortable, obviously, but in retrospect, I give him a lot of credit for that. Because one of the problems, I would argue, one of the problems with our vast national security bureaucracy is that you have too few people like this. You have too many people who, like I said, are in the guild or in the inner circle and want to remain there.
Mm-hmm.
And so any doubts you have, any emotions you have, you're just supposed to check those at the door because of what your colleagues might think of you, right? Because of the possible implications for you or your career. So you just keep all that bottled up or you leave.
Right.
And so I would give him credit for being someone who actually, I'll put it this way, sort of acted on his emotions and acted on his sort of emotional intelligence, right? And I understand what's going on here. I have the power to do something about it. I need to step up and do that.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting, especially given that he was part of the intoxicating part of the club and then moved out. Yeah.
Exactly. So he, by this point, he has concluded that basically, if you are fighting a war that you know you can't win and suspect that you shouldn't be fighting, and yet you continue to fight it, that's tantamount to murder.
Right.
Not just unnecessary violence or collateral damage or whatever other spin you'd put on. He basically says that's murder. You are killing people who you shouldn't be killing for any reason.
Both the enemy, presumably, and your own soldiers getting killed.
Correct. But particularly, he's particularly disturbed by all the Vietnamese civilians who were being killed by this, especially by the bombing, for example.
Yeah.
So, and he concludes that he has to do what he can to stop it. And so in late 1969, along with a colleague, Daniel Russo, he secretly starts copying the Pentagon Papers.
Okay, now we have to show, because I hate to admit it, but you and I are now of the older generation of buzzkillers. We have to remind the younger generation of buzzkillers that the scene in the beginning, I think, of the very beginning of the movie is when they're photocopying,
that's right,
what we used to call Xeroxing the papers. That was an extremely laborious process.
Very manually
page by page.
Yes, because manually you have to put individual pages on the glass and wait a long time for the light to pass under it.
Yeah.
By the way, he's smuggling this stuff out of Rand, from the top secret locker, and then go into this other place where he has a friend who has a like, I think at first it's a, like an advertising agency where they have a his friend has a copier. He's doing this all after hours, of course, including pulling some all nighters, just standing at the machine manually photocopying these thousands and thousands of pages. And at first he looks for he decides what he can do is he can leak these papers.
Well, the reason I say that is because photocopying thousands and thousands of pages, you might, after a while, you might just say, oh, the hell with this. It's not going to make a difference. The drudgery of doing that might highlight the drudgery of going on this crusade.
Right.
And I think most people would have given up.
Well, and there are all these little things that you don't necessarily think about. For example, he has to be careful that, first of all, he has to pull apart these volumes that are held together by those sort of brads.
Yeah.
And he's
got
to put them back together and make it look like no one ever took them apart.
Yeah.
All these pages have, in big letters, top secret on them. So if you leave, and he almost gets caught by like these local cops at one point. If you leave him a single page that you've copied upright on a desk and someone sees the words top secret.
Yeah.
And later on, he actually has copies made at a copy shop.
Yeah.
Well, if some flunky at the copy shop says, okay, I'm going to do a job. Wait, what's all this top secret stuff? And that person calls the cops.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many ways this could have gone south for him. And it's kind of amazing that it didn't. But in any case, so he decides, so he starts copying it, and then he decides he's going to leak it. And then the question is, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And first, his idea is he will go to find a sympathetic, maybe an anti-war U.S. senator, who will then read it into the record. And I think, if I ever understand this properly, one of the reasons you go to U.S. senator is, I think under Senate rules, basically, if you read something into the record in the Senate, it's essentially sacrosanct. Like, you're basically... You are legally untouchable as a senator doing that.
Oh, and a representative, a congressman, doesn't have that protection?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it could be because of different rules in the two bodies, but wow, certainly in the Senate. And so he basically, as we would say, he starts shopping it around. And he contacts people. One is Charles Mathias of Maryland, who's a senator, and more famously to us, George McGovern.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he basically doesn't get any takers.
Minnesota senator, yeah.
No, he's South Dakota.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, all that upper Midwest stuff. Even now.
Yeah, George McGovern, who was obviously notoriously anti-war senator, right, but even him, like, won't touch these. And so then
even with that protection, they won't touch it. So that, again, this shows you how dangerous it was.
Right. Well, and also unprecedented. I mean, never has a massive, as far as I know, a massive top secret study that's still top secret been put in front of a senator. Hey, Senator, how do you like to declassify this on your own?
And right? Not willing to do it even with the senatorial protection.
That's right.
Wow.
So, you know, there's anti-war and then there's anti-war, I guess I would say. So we start circulating to others. There's another think tank. It's called a very liberal think tank called the Institute for Policy Studies. They end up with a copy. And Neil Sheehan of the New York Times, famous New York Times reporter, who had covered Vietnam quite a bit in the early 60s.
Right.
He
later wrote Bright Shining Lie.
Right. Later wrote this classic book, Bright Shining Lie, about John Paul Vann and Vietnam.
And by the way, I think this is the opening journalistic aspect of the movie where they're The Washington Post is constantly wondering why the New York Times is holding this big section.
Well, and also why Neil Sheehan hasn't published anything
for a long time.
For weeks.
He must be working on something.
Exactly. I've loved those cases where, like, the dog that didn't bark. Yeah. It's like, how come he's not publishing all of a sudden? What is he up to? Yeah, and that's accurate in the movie where, for example, they rent all these hotel rooms and basically set up this Pentagon Papers command center the New York Times does.
Yeah.
That's accurate. That's how that's how that went down. So Neil Sheehan becomes the way that Ellsberg gets parts of the papers to the New York Times. And if you look into this, it's very, very complicated and confusing because different parts and different versions of the Pentagon Papers are leaked to different people at different times. Mm-hmm. There is, people who study the Pentagon Papers may have heard of the Gravel edition. There's a Senator Gravel who reads, not on the floor of the Senate. He's a freshman senator, by the way, and he wants to make an anti-war splash. And he is actually, once this starts coming out, he's willing to read the papers in their entirety on the Senate floor as a filibuster. Uh-huh. And he is shut down by a parliamentary maneuver. So then he calls a meeting of, I think it's the Subcommittee on Buildings and Grounds, middle of the night. There's no one else attends the meeting, so he is free to read the Pentagon Papers into the record.
Again, which must have been very laborious.
I think you can start reading it, and then you can say, the rest of this entering into the record.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, I don't think he had to read the whole thing. He'd probably still be reading.
Yeah, but, that's right. Yeah.
But so then the Beacon Press, which is run by the Unitarian Church in Boston, they end up publishing what's called the Gravel edition of the Pentagon Papers and multi-volume massive thing. So that's one of the publicly available versions fairly early on.
Oh, okay.
The so-called Gravel edition. When I first heard about the Gravel edition,
when
there's a paved edition later on, it's like, I didn't understand. But in any case, so the New York Times famously publishes the first extract in, I think, June 13th, 1971.
Now, do we know, did they choose a particularly juicy extract, or did they just choose the first page?
That's a good question.
Pretty boring.
No, it wasn't the first page, but I don't remember what extract it is. But no, I remember they were trying to be very strategic. And because,
they chose one, okay.
And because partly their thinking, like Ellsberg's thinking, is at any minute this process could be shut down.
Oh, sure.
So, and that's one of Ellsberg's fears, because there's a point after the New York Times first publishes, Ellsberg's basically on the lam for 2 weeks. He successfully evades the FBI for 2 weeks. They've got this nationwide manhunt, and he's hiding out in hotel rooms.
Sixes.
Yeah, pretty much, essentially in Cambridge. And, and at the same time, leaking bits of it to additional newspapers, trying to stay one step ahead of the government and the courts, trying to trying to shut this
in
down.
In a funny way, that would have been easier to hide out in those days. You're not swiping your credit card
exactly
through,
right. You know. Your footprint is not so large. Mm, so yeah, he is successful, and then he just turns himself in a little bit later. In any case, let me just insert at this point, like, the basic question: what do the Pentagon Papers reveal?
We're talking about all the drama of all this happening,
right?
But we don't really know what they're talking about,
right? And context is important because public understanding of the Vietnam War circa 1971 was not nearly what it is now,
right?
In terms of how and why policy was made, why we were there, the explanation behind certain events. I think even in the broad public today, there is a much, much better understanding of how we got into Vietnam and how the war was fought and why it didn't work than there was then. Because remember, as circa 1971, your understanding of the Vietnam War, even if you're super interested in it, is what you read in the newspapers and magazines and what the government says.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And your reporters will interview people. Sometimes they'll get people on background, but there aren't any major scoops necessarily that fly in the face of what the government is saying. There are some exceptions, obviously. A lot of people like David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan, they're writing rather critical stuff about the Vietnam War. But still, that's very, very limited compared to what's in the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers essentially, in a nutshell, reveal routine lying by every single president since Harry Truman when it comes to Vietnam.
Lying.
Routine. High and low on big and little issues. I mean, this is just a partial list. And by the way, lying not only to the American people, but also to Congress.
Wow. And when there might be protections in Congress and they're still lying to them.
Right. Still lying to them. Yeah, exactly. In Congress, who even people who might be sympathetic to you and your policy, you're lying to them.
Yeah. And even hawks on the other side.
Exactly. Wow. And lies about pretty much every aspect of the war. Lying, for example, about the nature of the threat.
Uh-huh.
Lying about the nature of the South Vietnamese government and how democratic it is,
right.
And lying about some of the things it does, lying about U.S. chances for success when we take a particular step, like increasing the bombing or increasing the number of troops we have there, lies about the Geneva Accords from 1954, which ended the first war, the French War, the war that divided Vietnam, quote-unquote, temporarily into North and South Vietnam. And that, by the way, had spelled out that there would be nationwide elections 2 years down the road in 1956. And these were, we now know, stymied by the United States because the United States, like the South Vietnamese regime in Saigon, knew that free nationwide elections would elect Ho Chi Minh, the communist.
And the whole country would be
officially and fairly unified under communist rule, and we couldn't have that. So that is not revealed publicly and is in the Pentagon Papers. The complicity in the overthrow of the Diem regime in 1963. No Dinh Diem was the South Vietnamese president who we backed between 54 and 63. His overthrow, which we were knee-deep in. LBJ's intentions in 1964, right? LBJ's running for president in 1964 and repeatedly lying to the American people about what's going on behind the scenes. For example, he's clearly, Ellsberg's very good on this, he's clearly planning an escalation and not telling the American people. And then, of course, we escalate right after he's reelected.
Yeah, yeah.
It lies about the Tonkin Gulf incident, lies about the pace and the reasons behind the Americanization of the war. I mean, the list, that's a partial list. The list is long and it includes major items and then individual events as well. And that's why this was such a big deal at the time, because it was a revelation that not just LBJ,
right,
not just this general or this particular program, that there was this sort of corruption, if I can use that term, high and low from the get-go, from 1945, from the beginning of the years that this study covers.
And that's any one of these things, the Tonkin Gulf, the 64 intention, the complicity in the Diem overthrow, any one of these things would have been a huge scandal.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I mean, I'm just sort of freelancing here, but I suspect in a way it was almost too much.
Yeah.
In other words, it floods the zone, and then you just become sort of numb with all these revelations.
Oh, right.
But
they were
only a fraction of the papers, for example, were either showed up or were discussed in the New York Times because they're just so voluminous.
Oh, okay.
Even once the New York Times starts publishing more and more and more. And by the way, the New York Times, I've seen these around. You can see them in used bookstores. The New York Times also published a paperback version.
I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember. I remember.
I'm pretty sure it was a bestseller.
Mid-70s, yeah. Well, this is a big splash, as you say. But let's take a quick sponsorship break, and we'll get back to the effects of that splash. Back in a sec. Well, Professor, it's a little difficult to come back from a positive and uplifting sponsorship break to talk about the effects of these, the devastating, well, the upsetting information that the Pentagon Papers has revealed, and of course the effects and the continually devastating effects they had on confidence in the government, among other things. But so what happens after all this information is out?
Well, I'll provide uplift by bringing in Richard Nixon.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That makes me feel a lot better.
what could possibly provide more uplift than Richard Nixon? As I'm sure buzzkillers understand, the Nixon administration is an administration that wouldn't have the best predisposition when it comes to someone like Ellsberg leaking this top secret information to the press. And by the way, it's in print. It's also available, I think, online. You can listen to a lot of the White House conversations.
That's right.
On the subject of the Pentagon Papers, and they are sort of fascinating. They're not great quality, and often you can't understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
But we know enough, and they're a great source in understanding how the Nixon administration reacts to the leaking of the Pentagon Papers. The Nixon administration and its Justice Department basically very quickly moves to quash publication of the Pentagon Papers.
Okay.
And here we get into the subject of what's called prior restraint, where for the first time in history, the government is trying to prevent the press from publishing something. Usually what happens, it's the other case where, in other words, they publish something and then after it's published, the administration decides to go after the leaker or to say you can't publish this. This is preemptive, right? This is you're not allowed to publish any more of this because it's top secret information.
Ah, gotcha.
Okay. So they go to court to get injunctions. And there's this 2-week period where the New York Times is basically not allowed to publish as the judge sort of makes a decision, sort of pending their final decision. And that's when the Washington Post steps in. And this is shown in the movie, right? This gives an opening to the Washington Post because they have not been enjoined against publication. Only the New York Times has.
Oh, okay.
And as the movie points out, the Washington Post is also getting leaks from Daniel Ellsberg.
Okay. See, that's one of the things I
didn't, Ben Bagdikian,
quite understand about this is that why isn't this movie the New York Times rather than the Post? But I guess it's that 2-week period.
That's right.
And supposedly the tension with her new ownership, Katie Graham.
That's right. Yeah. Because a lot of that movie is about Katharine Graham and her sort of coming into her own as a publisher of the Washington Post. Because as the movie makes quite clear, Washington Post was sort of stuck as second or third fiddle. Mm-hmm, the New York Times was the flagship and got all the attention and all the best reporters, blah, blah, blah. So in any case, Nixon administration is moving hard against Ellsberg and the leaks. As the Washington Post steps in, then other papers. There's a famous scene in the movie where I guess Brand Bradley brings in a big paper bag full of all these other newspapers that are starting to publish. And that's a really important point here, because had it been only the New York Times, this story might have ended differently.
Yeah.
And so in other words, the laudable courage from the press is pretty widespread in this story. You have a lot of editorial boards and publishers making this hard decision and making the courageous and the right decision.
And presumably, I mean, I'm trying not to get ahead of ourselves. The court or whoever, this is part of their realization. We can't stop them all.
That's right.
If they all do it, then you know.
Right. Although I mean, ultimately, the Supreme Court rules, and very quickly, rules 6-3 that the government has not met its burden of proof required for a prior restraint injunction.
Right.
Which, to me, is not the best possible decision, because what they're basically saying is that another government under other circumstances could have met that burden of proof, and then prior restraint would have been justified.
Okay, so it's not a huge banner day for freedom of the press.
Well, I mean, not as huge
it
as
is,
it is.
It
is,
correct. Backward sort
it,
of way.
It could have been huger, I would argue. So, yeah, they're basically saying you haven't met the burden, but there might be other cases where you do meet the burden.
Right.
But it is a 6-3, right? It's not a 5-4 decision. It is 6-3. And let's keep in mind, this is no longer the liberal Warren court of the 50s and 60s.
It's
now the Warren-Burger court, which is a little more conservative, not nearly as conservative as today's Supreme Court.
Burger appointed by Nixon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right, to replace
Chief Earl
Justice, Warren. Warren-Burger, that's right. Yeah, so sometimes I wonder just sort of if we had a similar or identical case today, how would the court rule? I'm not quite so sure.
Right, okay.
Although, of course, now you have this precedent. Now, I should point out, and this is, to my mind, the closest we come to a myth and it's not a huge myth. Maybe it's not even a mini myth, but Nixon and his defenders would argue that they were so aggressive in pursuing these leaks and pursuing Ellsberg, who they indict, by the way.
Yeah,
and I'll get more of that in a minute. That they're taking a principled stance against leakers. In other words, if you work for the government and you have a top secret clearance and you violate that, in effect, oath, you should be punished.
Uh-huh.
And that's a nonpartisan sort of pro-national security stance against all leakers.
Okay, so Nixon is saying, in theory, Nixon would be saying, we don't want any leaks, even if they occurred and might look, the Johnson administration look bad, we don't, that's bad. No, right. None of these government/military leaks at all.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
And you can make a really plausible and even strong argument that that's how things have to be. In fact, I would make that argument myself, right? In terms of, for example, can you undertake secret negotiations with any other country if they know that what they're saying behind closed doors in secret with your representatives might end up in the New York Times the next day? Right, that could make national security and foreign policy very, very difficult to execute if you don't have laws or rules that back up your security clearances and your secrecy system.
Yeah, sure.
So I mean, that's certainly plausible,
but that's not what happened.
That's not where Nixon and his people were. Not surprisingly, it's quite clear from the White House tapes. We didn't know this at the time. We know it now because of all the information about Watergate and the Nixon taping system, which was put in place early 1971. By the way.
Oh, okay. Okay.
A lot of people know this. There was a taping system in place under LBJ. Nixon comes in and tears it out.
Right.
And then puts it back in early 1971 in time to catch some of these conversations that involve the Pentagon papers.
Okay.
So it's quite clear from the tapes that Nixon was delighted that the leaks were making Democratic administrations look bad.
Which had been the run. It had been
correct.
LBJ, JFK, and then apart from Eisenhower, Truman before that.
Right. Exactly. So he wanted more leaks to be made that made the Democrats look bad.
Oh.
For example, especially when it comes to the overthrow of Nodin Diem in late 1963.
Uh-huh.
He wants more information leaked because he and some people suspected, and by the way, it's one of the mistakes the movie makes.
Yeah.
JFK and his administration signed off on the overthrow of Diem, not the assassination of Diem.
Oh.
It is quite clear that they wanted him either imprisoned or sent into exile. And there's excellent evidence that JFK was personally horrified when he found out that Diem had not just been overthrown, but executed by his military.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Nixon was convinced that JFK had ordered Diem's killing. And then so he had his people look for evidence, including people like E. Howard Hunt, famously of Watergate.
Later, yeah.
And when Hunt didn't find that information, this was not at Nixon's request, but Hunt then went and forged some documents. He forged documents that implicated JFK in the assassination. They were never released because he could never, speaking of technology, he could never make the forgeries legit because he didn't have the right typewriter that they used in 1963.
Again, we get back to the technology.
Exactly.
Xerox machines, typewriters.
It's all about the technology. In other words, had he released them, an expert could have looked at them and said, these aren't genuine.
The IBM Selectric, no doubt.
This happened to Dan Rather back in 2004, as I recall, when it came to George Bush and the National Guard. Remember that?
Oh, right.
One of the reasons they found these memos were fake because it was the wrong typewriter.
What goes around comes around.
Typewriter's like a fingerprint. Anyway, so it is true that Nixon and his people want to deter future leakers generally. But the real story here is they're terrified about what Ellsberg and any Ellsberg Confederates might leak about Nixon.
Okay.
And his national security advisor, Kissinger, and their running of the war in Vietnam.
Because what we talked about up until now is that Ellsberg is not leaking stuff about 69, 70.
Because he doesn't have it.
Yeah, it's leaking others. He's leaking earlier stuff, but Nixon doesn't know that is what you're saying.
Okay. What he does know is that, and I should have said this, Ellsberg does do some initial work for the Nixon administration in early 1969.
Oh,
there's this, I think it's National Security Study Memorandum number 1, and it's about options for Vietnam. Uh-huh. Ellsberg worked on that. But more importantly, at this point in 1971, Nixon and Kissinger and others in the White House, they don't know exactly what Ellsberg has and might yet leak.
Right.
They don't know, for example, if he only has the Pentagon Papers or if he has a lot of other stuff. They also don't know that regardless of what he may or may not have, they don't know that there's not somebody still inside the White House or the national security bureaucracy who is leaking Nixon stuff to Ellsberg.
Oh, so there could be a lot of little Ellsbergs in there somewhere, everywhere.
Exactly. So in other words, Ellsberg might not be the source, but he might be the conduit for Nixon and Kissinger stuff. And remember, those of you who know Vietnam, Nixon and Kissinger from the getty-up have all sorts of secrets of their own to keep. For example, the secret bombing of Cambodia.
Yep.
That's still a secret in 1971.
Right.
It's not secret to the Cambodians or to the Vietnamese. It's secret from the American people and a lot of the American government.
Yeah.
By the way, which is a huge subterfuge that includes a forging of documents. It includes lying, in some cases lying to pilots about the coordinates that they have to bomb.
Wow.
It's insane. Yeah. So they have this is a particularly paranoid administration because they should be particularly paranoid. They have a lot of secrets. They have a lot of secrets to keep.
So isn't just what the common sort of trope about Nixon is that his paranoia drives larger executive branch paranoia. There is other stuff going on.
There are many layers to it. No question.
Oh,
no question. And they certainly want to send an example, right? If they land hard on Ellsberg, then any other potential leakers will be deterred.
Right. Sure.
That's true.
And during all this time, Nixon is trying to, or some of the Nixon administration is trying to plan his daughter's wedding.
Exactly.
The stresses must be immense.
It is hard to be president. There's no question.
Yeah.
So they decide to prosecute Ellsberg to the full extent of the law. They also decide in true Nixonian fashion that they're not just going to do that, that they are going to also try to destroy him publicly, destroy him in the press, and, for example, dig up dirt on him to discredit him.
On him personally.
And that's why the special investigative unit in the White House breaks into the office of Dr. Lewis Fielding, who is Ellsberg's psychiatrist.
I'll say
more about that later. But this is, that break-in happens in the context of the Pentagon Papers case. They want to discredit Ellsberg. They're hoping to find all sorts of embarrassing material in his psychiatrist's files about Ellsberg. They'll release it, and then no one will believe Ellsberg because they'll think he's a nut.
Wow. Break-ins is a big deal starting in 71 we're talking about?
Yeah, 71. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and actually, apart from the obvious, the Watergate break-in, this is one of the major black bag jobs of the Nixon people.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ones that it's sort of, in other words, it's a major piece of the Watergate puzzle.
Yeah. So in some ways, this makes me wonder whether in the old days when you would have to go in and steal, borrow the paper files of Ellsberg's psychiatrist, whether that might not have been more secure, it'd be easier to hack into the psychiatrist's computer records of their patients rather than try to find and photocopy.
Right. Yeah, I just saw paper files. I just saw an interview with John Le Carré the other day, where he's basically saying now that he was arguing that human intelligence is still really important and in some ways more important than it used to be. Because the way you communicate securely now is you meet somebody in public.
Yeah.
You don't communicate by email or your phone or any. Those are all traceable. But a human conversation is the one thing that's not traceable. Yeah, it's like old school.
Yeah, John Le Carré, of course, famously an old spy.
Right.
And then, of course, a novelist.
So Ellsberg is charged with multiple violations of the Espionage Act. 100 years old last year, by the way.
All right.
Maybe we should do a show on the Espionage Act.
Does that have anything to do with the war? With World War One?
Absolutely. Espionage Act and also conspiracy and burglary. He's looking at well over 100 years in the penitentiary.
Okay.
And by the way, he understood this when he decided to leak.
Oh, early on?
He was okay with him spending he was ready to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he knew what he was doing was that serious.
Wow.
And so,
that's a major sacrifice.
Not that you care, but my personal view is that he did the right thing, and he probably should have gone to prison for it.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Okay. Right. I mean, I don't see a contradiction there.
Yeah, because you're saying that he was violating the law.
And that there are good reasons for those laws.
Yeah, sure. As you said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking. But so he did the right thing, and he should have gone to prison for it. So if you look at the way the Nixon administration handles this case, it's not very impressive.
Oh.
I would, from what I've seen, I think Ellsberg had much better representation than the Justice Department did. A lot of the prosecution of Ellsberg is very amateurish. It's very seat of the pants. There are some people writing briefs who actually haven't looked at the Pentagon Papers.
That's surprising.
Yeah. And, you know, partly there's a time crunch, but still they're making an argument that this is a major, that this is damaging to national security.
Yeah.
How can you make that argument if you actually haven't looked at the Pentagon Papers?
Which are now out. It's not like you have to go
right. And for example, one of the sort of mini defeats that the administration suffers as court is they say, well, we can't, this leak is bad because it disrupts our conduct of foreign policy, right? It disrupts our diplomacy because, like I said, it disrupts the security of your diplomacy.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, that's not in the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg deliberately withheld what are called the diplomatic volumes for that very reason. Ellsberg, by the way, was very careful about, for example, not revealing sources or methods, not releasing anything that might disrupt the secret, or not the secret, but the negotiations with the North Vietnamese, not giving up the identity of someone whose life might be put in jeopardy by the leak. Right? He was very, very careful about that. And the administration sort of didn't get that. And so they're very ham-handed in the way they prosecute.
Yeah.
But more importantly is the fact that the administration and the Justice Department engage in misconduct.
Oh.
And that's going to get the case thrown out. Because during the trial, especially this is the spring of 73, and speaking of multiple layers.
This is dragging on for a long time.
Yeah, it does. And this is April of 73 when a lot of stuff goes down. This is when some of the top Nixon people are fired or forced to resign because of Watergate.
Uh-huh.
The Watergate hearings are about to start. Yeah. It's a very chaotic period. And so this trial in D.C. court is coming to a head. The judge, William Byrne, learns in the middle of the trial that the administration has been involved in illegal wiretapping relating to the case.
Yeah, relating to the Ellsberg case.
Ellsberg case, that they have destroyed evidence related to the Ellsberg case, that there is relevant evidence that they have failed to share with the defense.
That's not legal.
Nope.
Yeah.
No, any one of these, by the way, would have been sufficient conceivably to have the case thrown out.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And then on top of that, it turns out, and this was not relevant to the case being dismissed because the judge didn't, he argued there wasn't a problem, but the judge was offered the directorship of the FBI by the Nixon administration during the trial.
You mean, we'll give you this better job?
Yeah. Not proper. Right, no, right. Once again, this is the classic, I mean, even if it's theoretically on the up and up, it creates the appearance of impropriety, right? Yeah. You're not supposed to be even having meetings ex parte
with the
prosecution. You're not supposed to do that.
And this was done by, who was offering? Was it actually Nixon offering or one of the
underlings? It was Byrne meets with Ehrlichman, of Watergate fame, who is what? He's a special counsel to the president. Wow. So he argued that it didn't affect his judgment, but presumably, presumably this would have provided really good grounds for appeal if Ellsberg had been found guilty, right? I mean, that's something you could hang a pretty big hat on. It's like, yeah, the judge wasn't acting fairly because he was being courted by the administration. Sure. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Sure.
So in May of 73, Judge Byrne dismisses all charges with prejudice.
What does that mean? What does with prejudice mean?
With prejudice means that you cannot try this guy again for these crimes.
Oh, okay.
In other words, for example, a mistrial, if you've watched any of your courtroom dramas on TV, a mistrial, you can always choose to retry later on.
Okay.
In this case, the judge is saying, not only am I dismissing these charges, you can't bring these charges against the defendant again.
Okay, so this really quashes the whole
pretty good day for Ellsberg.
Putting Ellsberg in the slammer.
That's right.
Well, let's take another break briefly for station identification, and we'll come back to really get into the meat of things about what do the Pentagon Papers do? Why are they so? What does this whole story? What does this whole revelation do? Why is it so important? Back in a second.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network. and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back. Professor, this is so complicated, or at least sounds so complicated. It's been presented in a movie. It's presented in popular, you know, history books and everything. But it's almost so complicated, you would say, well, I give up. I can't understand why these Pentagon Papers are so important, and what did they do?
As I like to call it, the so what question.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
Very important. And by the way, and the whole story is far more complicated than I presented it here.
Sure.
If you get, you can really get into the weeds on the Pentagon Papers and the Ellsberg case and all that other stuff. So first of all, people should know what the papers don't represent and what they didn't do. And let's keep in mind, Ellsberg's goal was to end the war.
Right.
That didn't work. There's no evidence that the papers, had they been released earlier, who knows. But when they were released in 71, it's pretty clear they have no effect on the outcome of the war.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't really, as far as I know, it doesn't really narrow Nixon's options. Nixon is already, by the way, drawing down the troop levels pretty steadily.
I see.
So, okay. So our ground combat role is steadily shrinking. It was already shrinking, and it continues to shrink.
Nixon, the de-Americanization of the war?
As they call it, the Vietnamization of the war. That was the term they used. He still continues bombing, and in 72, he's going to bomb very, very heavily. More than once. So, and Ellsberg's quite open about this. Ellsberg in his book says, I didn't achieve my goal. That releasing these papers, while it may have been worthwhile, did not achieve the goal I was starting out to achieve. Nevertheless, the papers are still very, very important in our history and in the history of Vietnam, in the history of our government, for several reasons. One is what it represents in the world of secrecy.
Okay.
It's an important chapter in the history of secrecy and tells us a lot of things important about government secrecy. And, for example, it's interesting that Ellsberg, his memoir on this is called Secrets.
Yeah, sure.
That's the title. Because secrecy, I think, is something that didn't get a lot of attention before this. And it gets more attention today, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It was made quite clear by the Pentagon Papers and by other stories since then that the government is overly secretive, and that the default on most, if not all, parts of the government is to, when in doubt, keep a secret.
Right.
And when in doubt, don't allow the public to know what you're doing to a ridiculous extent.
Even if you might not have the right reason to
exactly.
Doing it.
Exactly. And for example, what this case makes clear is that the claims of the Nixon administration that this was a disastrous leak for national security, that was a load of crap. That just was not, flat out not true and not sustainable.
Didn't happen. Yeah.
That's right. And one also, because this was a document of historical importance. Mm-hmm. And even though it released thousands and thousands of pages of top secret documents, the security of the country was not undermined by their release.
Right,
and this is an
right.
ongoing issue. People like me still wrestle. We talked about this on another show. People like historians like me, we constantly wrestle with the fact that the government, when in doubt, keeps stuff secret. And then when it finally comes out, it's like, why were you keeping that secret? This is ridiculous. Why are you redacting this document in such a way that I can figure out what it says anyway? Right?
Sort
of most, I would call it ridiculous secrecy.
Right.
Part of the problem here is what's called overclassification, which is
the same impulse.
Yeah, it's sort of a different version of the same impulse.
Okay,
so something that shouldn't be secret, you make secret. Something that should be marked confidential, you make secret. Something that's secret or ought to be secret, you call it top secret.
Oh, you're something bumping everything up,
right? That something that's top secret, you make top secret eyes only. Or, right, in other words, you and
eyes only presumably means you can't take notes, you can't copy it.
Right, and it's only the recipient listed on the document gets to see it.
Right.
No one else, no secretaries, no one else. And I've seen other stories of this, and I assume this is still the case. Partly what's going on here is bureaucratic. Is that when you're writing a memo, and it shouldn't be classified, and you put up at the top unclassified, no one will read it.
Ah, because it's not...
In other words,
not important enough.
Right. Yeah. It's this bureaucratic game. How do you get your stuff noticed? So there's this sort of natural, it's very, very mundane even, very prosaic.
Mm.
But there's this natural upward tendency on classification within the bureaucracy.
Oh, right. So,
and that's the sort of thing that is given some attention by the Pentagon Papers, and that's an issue which we should constantly be wrestling with, and some people are.
Some people within the places where things are being overclassified.
Mostly people on the outside.
Okay.
Yeah, it's worse in some areas. The CIA, I would argue, has a particularly bad attitude. Mm-hmm. They're still classifying some stuff from World War II.
Oh, right.
And, you know,
everyone's
once again,
dead.
Yeah. Right. Their mantra is always sources and methods. Well,
oh, okay.
What sources and methods are you going to reveal by declassifying a 1942 OSS document?
Right.
And seriously.
Right. Because you have totally different sources and totally different methods.
Exactly.
Right.
And partly, as I argue, this reflects this underlying attitude of basically, I'm in the government, I get the secrets, you're an outsider, you're a peon, you'd never get to see this stuff. If I have my way, you never get to see this because you're not me. You're not in the government. You're not cleared. So basically shut up and go about your business.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And I think that's a problem, which is sort of pointed up by the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers also tell us a lot about the status and impact the status of the presidency.
Right.
Because remember, and all the public opinion polling shows this pretty clearly, that into the mid-60s, significant majorities of Americans basically believe what their politicians and their presidents tell them.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's
a big change.
They believe that the government is being straight with them on major issues of policy.
Mm-hmm.
That reality is destroyed by many things,
mm-hmm.
including Vietnam broadly, including Watergate,
mm-hmm.
including some other things, but also the Pentagon Papers.
Right, okay.
Because the Pentagon Papers, like I said, reveal sort of systematic government lying. And
tell
us, in our sort of jaded time period today, it's not such a big deal, right? If we say, oh, this politician lied, we're like, well, yeah, so what else is new? But
exactly,
back then, especially this sort of pace and sort of intensity of lying by so many people for so long on such a major issue was really eye-opening for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And really did, I think, help knock the status of the presidency down a peg or two.
Somewhat shown in symbolized in the movie by Ben Bradley having a JFK wasn't perfect moment.
That's right.
By looking at his portrait, and you get this kind of regret.
That's right.
Or this idea in his.
And by the way, just parenthetic. I thought that was handled very well in the movie.
That part
is basically the tension between honest reporting and access, because people like Ben Bradley and Catherine Graham, these are connected people. They're part of the Washington.
Sure,
they're part of the Washington elite.
In fact, they're part of the Georgetown
exactly
club, sort of.
And so, and once again, it's a different version of what I said about Ellsberg. In other words, you're part of this club, and it has rules, and you don't tell tales out of school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people should look up what happened to Truman Capote, for example.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you all of a sudden violate those rules, that's a problem. And it can be extremely awkward if you're personal friends with Bob McNamara.
Right.
When you go against him and you write stories and make him look bad, and then you ask him, like, what's up with this? And he has no good answer for that. I mean, that's a really awkward moment if you're friends.
That's right. You're not going to go to his garden party. You're not going to get your...
Exactly.
The invitation to his garden party is going to be withdrawn.
Well, and just broadly along these lines, people should look at what happened to Hubert Humphrey, who was LBJ's vice president. And he started internally, he didn't go public, he started internally criticizing the war, and he was basically banished. He was banished from LBJ's famous Tuesday luncheons, which were... These luncheons where they decided policy, and he was kicked out for years, and then he basically had to, you know, come back with his tail between his legs and admit he was wrong and become a team player.
Now this is just someone who questions stuff inside.
That's right.
Say.
And now that's largely about LBJ and his own sort of pathology.
Okay.
But still, I mean, you see versions of that elsewhere. Obviously, as the movie points out, this is a big story when it comes to press freedom.
And
in some ways, that's its most important contribution. I would say is that they're really. It's only a slight exaggeration, but I think there's sort of a pre-Pentagon Papers and a post-Pentagon Papers press.
Yeah,
and press attitude. The press, now, like I said, you saw some of it before in the early 60s. There was some critical reporting on Vietnam, which was very, very important.
Yeah, the worship or the fear of what Neil Sheehan might be doing had to come from somewhere.
Right. No, it already exists. And you have these, and you have a lot. I mean, it drove LBJ nuts. There's this famous anecdote where he watches Morley Safer giving a live or on the spot story about our war in Vietnam and why it's not going very well. And it shows these soldiers setting fire to huts. And apparently, you know, of course, Morley Safer is a Canadian. And LBJ apparently was watching this news broadcast and then turns to an aide and says, I knew he wasn't an American.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think tells you a lot as well about LBJ. Yeah. In any case, this is a good story with a good outcome, largely because of the behavior of the press. And the movie, once again, covers this very well. There are lots of people telling them you can't do this. The lawyers are certain telling you this. The people who are in charge of taking the Washington Post public and trying to sell shares and keep the stock price, the initial stock offering, right, and keep that price high. Yeah. They're worried about what would happen if you cross the administration. It's quite clear that this is an administration that's willing to freeze out reporters it doesn't like.
Yeah, which they can do.
Which they can do, and which you always have to worry about, right? If you're such an aggressive reporter that no one will talk to you, you're not going to be reporting very long. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have any sources. So I think this, the heroism of the press is sometimes overdone. We talked about this in the context of All the President's Men, for example.
Yes, many times. Greatly exaggerated.
So you can take this argument too far. There's no question about that. Nevertheless, the Pentagon Papers is a proud moment for the American journalism and helps set up, if not the reality, the possibility that the press, you know, that the Fourth Estate, that the press, right, sure, that the press has a legitimate role, not as a branch of government, but as a pillar of our democratic system and another part of the checks and balances.
Right, right.
That if the government is determined to pursue bad policy and the rest of the government, and by that I mean like the courts and Congress, are complicit, then what do you do?
Yeah, and the press is the only one that's outside.
In a case like that, the only option you have for a correction is the press. And that's why I become very dismayed when people sort of dismiss all journalists as whores or celebrities or useless or liars or whatever. When they do their jobs right, they have a really important role to play. Mm. And the Pentagon Papers really does demonstrate that. And then the last part, let's not forget, the Pentagon Papers has a big role to play in the story of Watergate.
Right, right.
Because the special investigative unit, which I think is the most awesome euphemism in the entire history of the United States.
We're going to have to rename our special investigative units here at the Institute, but call them something else.
Yes, Mr. Liddy, it certainly is special.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, these are the ones who are called the plumbers, i.e. people who stop leaks. The plumbers, when they are set up in July 1971, it's largely because of the Ellsberg case.
Yeah, right.
Now,
of course, we talked about them breaking into his psychiatrist's office.
That's right. And they're not acting as members of SIU at the time. They're members of CREEP, famously, the committee to reelect the president. But the people who break into the Democratic National Headquarters at the Watergate Hotel in May and June of 1972, these are a lot of former plumbers doing plumber stuff.
Yeah.
Well, not stopping leaks. They're trying to gather dirt on the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And by the way,
were they initially called plumbers because of the leaks thing? Is that where
yes.
that comes
from? One of the people in the SIU was talking with, I forget who it was, it may have been Eagle Crow, talking with his wife, and she made a joke like, "Boy, oh, you're all plumbers." and for a while, they actually, on next to the door in the office in the basement of the old executive office building, which I think it was, they actually put up a sign that said "The Plumbers," and then they took it down later.
That's hubris.
Yeah, pretty much. So these are some of the same people. Now, by the way, this is not a turning point, quote unquote, when it comes to Watergate.
Right, right, right.
The sort
right.
of the secrets that they're trying to protect and the abuses of power they're engaged in predate the Pentagon Papers.
Okay.
They certainly accelerate after the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
But not entirely just because of the Pentagon Papers. In other words, if you didn't have a Pentagon Papers case, you might still have had a Watergate break-in.
Okay, because I think what happens with these things, you get the Hollywoodization
right.
of this.
And then it's a turning point. Yeah, nothing was ever the same.
And
right.
Ben Bradley and Katharine Graham save the Republic and all this
that's
stuff.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And then later on, it gets worse.
Yeah. Right. And so, that's a natural thing.
That glorification gets worse and worse.
It's a natural danger with those sorts of movies. Yeah. It doesn't mean you shouldn't make those movies. It means you should read a book in addition to watching the movie.
We've got to remember that these things are movies. They are fictional representations of something
that's right. Happened. And they're, of necessity, simplifying things and sometimes combining characters or et cetera. But the first job of the plumbers of the SIU was the break-in at Dr. Lewis Fielding's office.
Right.
So you could argue that the first quote-unquote Watergate-style abuse and like, for example, burglary, that starts with this. And like I said, a lot of these people are going to go on to work for CREEP. A lot of these people are going to end up in prison.
Mm.
Some people like Gordon Liddy are going to end up with their own radio shows.
But they end up in prison because of Watergate, not because of the Pentagon.
Correct.
Lincoln.
Well, actually, no.
Oh, there's some sort of case against them, and
I think it's the break-in at Lewis Fielding's office. I think it was Bud Crow. I think at least one of them goes to jail because he basically ordered the burglary of Fielding's office.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm pretty sure Nixon knew about that break-in.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't know whether he knew about the Watergate break-in in advance. He was certainly involved in the cover-up. He certainly hired all the people who did it, and so I think he deserves some responsibility for that. I'm not at all exonerating him. But this, and he ordered another break-in, Nixon did. He's on tape doing this. He ordered another break-in that wasn't carried out.
Oh, right, okay.
Break-in to the Brookings Institution.
Wow, we could have had the Brookings scandal.
Exactly. They talked about firebombing it and then removing documents when the firefighters were there putting out the fire.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Nixon administration
that's
is the,
very par- that's
the Nixon administration
paranoia.
Is the gift that keeps on giving.
Oh,
it really is. No, we're just scratching the surface. But I mean, for example, Doug, we should do a Liddy show. Liddy is someone who
just on Gordon. Yeah.
Liddy is someone who, and I'm not making this up. Liddy is someone who either offered to either assassinate someone or be assassinated to draw attention away from Watergate.
Great. We should have a man anti-crush Monday on.
We should have a loyalty man man crush Monday. In any case, so a lot of these, so there's lots and lots of sort of dense connections between the Pentagon Papers and Watergate.
And I think as we've been talking, and so I'm getting sort of the same reaction that I got when I was watching the movie. I should know more about this. And the more you start to dig into this stuff, you realize the complications are immense.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that makes myth-making so easy is people either don't look into the complications, or they don't bother, or they fictionalize them, or they glorify certain heroes that they want to claim fixed it all. And we get, again, much more myth-making and much pyramids of myths come out of the early 70s.
That's right. By the way, and if I can just say one last thing, I highly recommend Ellsberg's own book called Secrets.
Okay.
Because
that's on the Buzzkill Bookshop,
yeah, that
by the
really,
way.
It really ought to be there because it's a fascinating read, and obviously it tells his point of view, mm-hmm. but it's mm-hmm. not entirely self-serving. I mean, he's fairly honest and critical of himself, and I highly recommend it.
And it also brings up these reservations and worries that he has and self-doubt and on.
Correct, yep.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. That's the first step in learning more and more about this. Read the Ellsberg book, and then go on to read the Pentagon Papers if you want. There are lots of additions. There's more... It's a lot easier to dip into the abridged editions, and they're fascinating and complex. And we'll talk to you next week.